You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online, wicn.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. Again, many of you know that I'm the history buff here at WICN. I just love American history. And every time I find a new book or get to meet a new author, especially a historian, I'm always marveled at, geez, how come I didn't know that? How come that's something that didn't end up on my radar screen? Well, I mean, that's just the way history is, and that's probably why so many history buffs are still enamored by all of that, because there's always something new. But going back to 1943, in fact, a new book came across my desk a few weeks ago, but back in January of 1943, for 10 days, President Franklin Roosevelt, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and their military high command met in secret in Morocco in hopes of defeating Germany, Italy, and Japan. And that meeting, for the most part, unless you are a staunch historian, that historic meeting really went by the waves until now. And that's why I've invited my guest this week, Massachusetts native James Conroy, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Devils Will Get No Rest. Jim, nice to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Jimmy, I like myself, you know, obviously you're a history buff as well, but I always think that one of the major battles, it could have gone either way. It could have affected, and it did, it affected millions and millions of people. I'm talking about World War II. You know, it was certainly a game changer for many, many nations. So you would always think that this would be preeminent in people's minds, and you don't have to be a history buff. Just the fact that this was a monumental moment. You know, today we think of Blinken is over there in China, and then he's moving on to other countries, and that becomes front page news. But this particular meeting, and you write about it in your book, seems to have gone by the wayside. Why is that?
Well, I think it's possibly because it was overshadowed by the later conferences in Potsdam and Yalta, which really were not so much oriented toward winning the war, but what to do after the war was won. You know, Yalta in particular, the outcome was known, really, it was a matter of time, and it consisted of dividing up spheres of influence and so forth. Whereas the Casablanca Conference was, first of all, secret, as you say, and secondly, not reported at the time except for the closing news conference, which only revealed a policy of unconditional surrender, that the Allies were going to demand the unconditional surrender of the Axis forces, you know, rather than negotiate a peace. So that story went out, but everything they discussed was secret, so none of that came out. And I think it just sort of passed away from people's consciousness.
The title is interesting, The Devils Will Get No Rest, because I'm sure some people are saying, well, who are the devils? Was it Roosevelt and Churchill? No, you're talking about Germany, Japan, Italy, correct?
Correct. Yeah, the background for that is at Casablanca, the American general in command of the 8th Air Force in England was delegated to convince Churchill to let the Americans continue with daylight bombing, what they referred to as precision bombing. It wasn't terribly precise, but it was more precise than it ever had been. And the Americans were attacking dams and factories and military targets in occupied France and Holland, while the British were bombing German cities by night. And Churchill wanted the Americans to abandon the daylight bombing and join the Brits at night. This American general, the son of a Texas sharecropper, Ira Eaker, convinced Churchill that keeping the Germans up and on the defensive all day and all night was the best way to go. And Churchill kind of bites on his cigar and says, "I like it. The devils will get no rest." So that's where the title comes from.
Very apropos, I would say, under the circumstances.
Right.
1943, so January of 1943, opening of a new year. At this point, where were we? Where were we in our allies in term? Were we at this point confident that it was a turning point, that we had the upper hand, or this was this thing still tenuous at that point and it could have gone either way? I'm talking about in terms of the war.
Sure. No, the war could definitely have gone either way. The essence of it is that the Japanese had been stopped offensively at the Battle of Midway and the Battle of the Coral Sea, which took place in spring of 42, and took out most of their carrier force and really left them unable to continue on the offensive. But they were far from beaten and still very, very strong. And in the European theater, the Allies had lost every battle that they'd fought, with the exception of the defensive battle of Britain. And it would only come about in the fall of 42 that the British, under General Montgomery, chased Rommel out of Egypt and across North Africa. And the Americans and the British invaded and took North Africa, and were now poised to go on the offensive for the first time in the war. So the Casablanca Conference was held to debate and decide where they would strike, either in the Mediterranean or across the English Channel, which is what the Americans wanted to do. And the British had the more subtle strategy of assembling an invasion force in North Africa that the Germans could see and knew would be coming, but they wouldn't know where. So they had to disperse their Mediterranean forces all the way across that region, and the Allies could attack them in strength at a spot where they were not as strong as they were in northern France.
Yeah, so this was a crucial moment for the Allies. It was either get it right or lose the war altogether. And I think and that's why I put so much emphasis, and I wanted to have you on, is because this was don't get me wrong, there were certainly pivotal moments throughout World War II, but you know, this was an opportunity for the Allies, if you will, to turn things around. I just want to take a quick pause to remind listeners, especially if you're just joining us, that this is 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and my guest this week is Hingham native James Conroy. His new book is The Devils Will Get No Rest. We're talking about the 10-day conference in Morocco back in 1943, where Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, and their military high command had really some intense conversation as to how to go about putting an end to World War II. And, you know, as a history buff, I think it was very important to bring forth this story, and I think Jim felt the same way. Jimmy, the thing, and you allude to this in the book, and it certainly makes perfect sense to me. You've got some larger-than-life figures. You've got Roosevelt, you've got Churchill, you've got Eisenhower, and a whole cast of others. Now, these aren't people that were, you know, where you blow in the wind and they're gone. These people were willing to face any challenge, and I guess for lack of a better term, were big personalities. So how difficult was it to get all of these guys under one roof for 10 days and get them to agree? I mean, were they amicable to one another? Did they fight at first? How did that all play out?
Well, two parts to my answer, I guess. One is that the list of mega personalities at this event is really staggering. In addition to all that you've mentioned, you've got Patton, you've got Charles de Gaulle, you've got Averell Harriman, you've got Harold Macmillan, you've got Lord Louis Mountbatten, and I could go on for 5 minutes. So it's an incredibly concentrated group of the leading personages in the Allied military force. Secondly, they had met several times before in Washington and in London, and they had established a kind of a rapport, but there was mutual suspicion and distrust on both sides. Cultural differences were very strong. The British had been a world power for 300 years. The Americans really had not. They were much less sophisticated militarily, politically, otherwise, but had tremendous potential strength. And you know, the British had been fighting the war for 3 years, and the Americans had yet to fire a shot in Europe at the time of this conference, you know, in early 1943. So there was a kind of big brother, little brother phenomenon, with the British being by far the more sophisticated players, but the Americans having this great coming force that had not yet been completely assembled, but both sides knew it would be. So there was a friendship and an alliance, but also a lot of tension and a lot of heated argument going on at this 10-day conference.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you say that, and I couldn't agree with you more, because I think back even further. Let's go back a century or more, and we're looking at the American Revolution. And, you know, I've always wondered, especially at that juncture in the 40s, did England harbor any animosity toward the U.S. After all, we broke away from England, you know, the colonies, and you know, became the country that we are today. So, as you said, between the big personalities and the fact of history dictating that England at that point was a major player on the global stage. Again, here's something that, as I was reading your book, I'm thinking, okay, you know, we hear this even today, Jim. Tell the politician, whenever there's a military engagement, get the politicians out of the room, let the military strategy, let the generals, let the people that do this day in and day out, 24/7, handle things. Now, you meant you read off a list of the, you know, the top of the line leaders, military leaders, between the Allies and the United States. But you also had, you know, the heads of state. Did that create any problems where you've got, you know, the military going, what do you guys know? This is what we do day to day. We're out there on the front lines. You're sitting behind a mahogany desk. Was there any kind of animosity there?
I wouldn't call it animosity. The way it was set up was that the military high command met separately in a resort hotel that they had requisitioned and surrounded with a mile of barbed wire, while FDR and Churchill met in their private villas within that barbed wire enclosure every day, had dinner almost every night, and just talked through political, military, diplomatic issues while the military guys were hammering it out in the other room. And as you say, that was a productive arrangement for the very reasons you recite. But three times during those 10 days, they all met together. And at those junctures, the military would go through what they were discussing and what their tentative decisions were. And Roosevelt and Churchill would debate and discuss all of that with them. And one thing I found fascinating is that there's, you know, there's respect shown to them, but no deference. So, you know, a brigadier general would take on FDR and tell him he was wrong. And Churchill would do the same with FDR. And it was very open, never heated in those three sessions, but often in disagreement and finding a way to hammer out their differences, which we ought to be able to do today, it strikes me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And but you know, as you know, you know as well as anybody, you know, some people can handle the criticism. Other people, you know, their personalities are so large, and they believe that the sphere of influence begins with them. So it was just amazing, especially at a turning point where, you know, things could have gone one way or the other. Let me ask you: as I was reading the book, I'm also thinking, okay, you know, the Germans were pretty sophisticated. No question about it. The German war machine was a force to be reckoned with. Was there any fear? Or was there any talk about the possibility that this gathering would leak out, or were Germany and their allies were they primed to any of this? Was there worry about spies?
There certainly was, and actually, there's a really kind of intriguing little vignette involved in this. Before the conference began, as I say, Patton commandeered this resort hotel and 14 luxurious villas that surrounded it, put a mile of barbed wire around it, anti-aircraft guns, spider planes overhead, British Marines, elite American troops. So you couldn't miss it. And people in the area were well aware something big was happening, and the place was riddled with spies, but they didn't know who and what. At one point, the German intelligence station in Spain, which was friendly to Germany, although not actively allied with them, but a spy in Spain wired Berlin that Roosevelt and Churchill were meeting in Casablanca. And some poor German officer translated Casablanca as White House. So the Germans were under the impression that they were meeting in Washington. Had they known where they were meeting, the Germans had bombed Casablanca 2 weeks earlier, so they would have been back in triple force, and the outcome probably would have been entirely different.
And that's the amazing, and I think you'd agree, I mean, you've been writing history for quite a while, that's just those are the kind of things that you really need to be cognizant of, is the fact that this was a world war. The smallest sliver of information leaking out could have been a major advantage to the enemy. And this point, as you said, Germany. Another question. I mean, I'm always interested in the personalities. And we knew Churchill was a well-known, no-nonsense leader. And I'm not downing Franklin Roosevelt. But again, the United States, as you said, was still a young country. We hadn't been, there was World War I. I suppose you can count that. But we weren't a nation known as a global superpower back then. Was Franklin Roosevelt looked upon by all the people that participated in this as maybe a rookie?
Well, yeah, let me just preface that, if I may. The book is a very character-driven book. I like you, am most interested in the people that are involved in these events. You know, the actual events are well-known. We know who won the war and all that. There's not a lot of suspense in that.
Mm-hmm.
What I drill down on is the personalities, what they thought of each other, how they interacted with each other is what interests me. And to answer your question, FDR, unlike Churchill, was not a military expert. Churchill had gone to Sandhurst, you know, the West Point of the United Kingdom.
Right.
Was a veteran of three wars, had written 24 volumes of military history, steeped in the military. FDR was not, and he had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy when he was younger, but in a junior role, and really had to learn what he needed to know about the military kind of on the fly, you know, in the late 30s. And so nobody put a very high premium on FDR's military acumen, but he was a tremendously talented politician and just had a natural way with people and a charm and an ability to get what he wanted through sheer force of personality and knowing how to pull the ropes. So he was very effective in his way, and Churchill certainly respected him. Their relationship is fascinating. At one point, FDR wired Churchill that it was fun to be in the same century with him. So it's really a fascinating interplay of personalities.
Yeah, I mean, there's a who. It's a who's who of military leaders and political leaders: De Gaulle, Churchill, Roosevelt, George Marshall, Dwight Eisenhower, George Patton. These were not people that played patty fingers. I mean, they were
right. Intense
men with strong personalities. So it was just interesting how you got so many. And you're right, it's really the most interesting part of your book is the fact that and I'm glad you wrote it the way you did and you approached it the way you did. Stories in themselves, the general overhaul is one thing because you have to set the tone, but what's most interesting to me is these individuals, how did they react? How were they working one, side by side? But it sounds like, they all had their differences and their personality quirks and whatnot, but it sounds like everybody had their eye on the end game. Is that how you look at it?
Yeah, they had to. You think about it. I mean, the weight of responsibility on these men is staggering. As you say, the war could have gone either way, and the decisions they made in those 10 days were going to pretty much decide which way it went in the end. And it's hard to imagine that kind of level of responsibility. The other part of it is that every one of them was an enormous ego, had achieved tremendous things. They all headed the Army or the Navy or the Air Force in their country were running their country as the politicians were. And they were not used to being toyed with and challenged and, told that they were wrong. So it creates a really interesting dynamic. But they all rode together. They had to, knowing that, the war was going to turn on whether they could come to an agreement, which they eventually did.
Jim, at the end of the day, after they had met for those 10 days, they came to some they came to an agreement on how to approach all of this. Who benefited the most from all of this? Did Roosevelt really come out smelling roses more so than anybody else, or did they all share in the success that the strategies that were developed here and were implemented down the road?
You know, one of the interesting things about the book is that the two men who really made it happen, who really made it come together, are obscure today. People have never heard of them. They were both British. One was a field marshal, Sir John Greer Dill, who had been stationed or was stationed in Washington, working with George C. Marshall in Washington as a liaison, and had come over with Marshall to Casablanca. And the other was an RAF officer by the name of Sir John Coatsworth Slessor. And the two of them, just by listening and taking notes and watching what was going on, they did not participate in the debates, but they were in the room. And the two of them together managed to come up with a compromise plan that they could see would work and convince both the British and the American senior command that this compromise is the way that they should go. And that's what really made the deal.
Yeah, I don't want to sound cliche here, but not unusual in the realm of the real world that those who didn't get the recognition that they probably rightfully deserved, or there were not major figures, came up with the real strategy that made this whole thing work. And I'm not downplaying what Churchill, De Gaulle, or Roosevelt had to say or did. The fact of the matter is, though, that subordinates, if you will, really came through, and it added something special to the book. And at least that's my personal feelings on this. We've got a few moments left, so I've got to ask you, what drew you to this?
Well, I was casting about for another subject. This is my fourth book, and happened to be watching a TV documentary about the Casablanca Conference, which I had known about. I was aware of it, but I didn't know much about it. And after watching that for an hour and seeing all those towering personalities together for 10 days enclosed in barbed wire, I thought, well, there's got to be a story there. And it turned out that there was.
Yeah. And what I like, as I said, these moments in U.S. history, world history for this matter, in this particular case, somebody brought it to life and didn't just talk about the basics, historical event that took place. You actually broke it down into the personality, which I find most fascinating because, as I said, and I think you'd agree 100% that you get these major figures and then one roof. I'll be honest with you, Jim, I think it would be almost impossible today to get anything accomplished the way these men did, knowing the level of influence that they had on the global stage, and just fast forwarding today. So it really took a lot of, eating humble pie, right?
Yeah, they really had to open their ears and their eyes. And as I say, again, I wish we could do that today. The cultural differences and the ideological differences, many other differences, were just as strong between the Brits and the Americans as they are today between the red and blue states. And I think it's a model for us all to look at.
Oh, without a doubt. I just want to remind listeners that Jim is also not only an award-winning author, but he's an honorary fellow at the Massachusetts Historical Society. And I know you practiced law for many years, Jim, but I got to take, as I've been since I was a kid, I mean, there were two things I loved most in school was art and history. So I got to assume that history was always something that stood out in your mind as well.
Yeah, from the age of six, literally.
That's young.
In my era, it was the Cowboys and Indians era, and that kind of drew me in, and I've been hooked ever since.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Again, the book is fascinating. I mean, you don't have to, and I think Jim would agree, you don't have to be a history buff. The Devils Will Get No Rest is truly centers on these personalities, major figures. And yeah, we've all heard many of the names, but as Jim has talked about, some of these names have gone unnoticed, and yet they played such a pivotal role in all of this. So I would urge people to go out and buy The Devils Will Get No Rest. Jim, if people want to get more information, just post questions to you directly, find out more about your background, how might they do that?
Sure. Well, my website is www.jamesbconroy, Conroy, .com. And it's got, a profile of myself and the other books and contact information. My email is an open door, so anybody who wants to communicate is welcome to.
Doesn't get any better than that. That's the open invitation. Again, the book is just recently released, so and it is widely in distribution now, so you should be able to find it either online or in your favorite local bookstore, and we always hope that you'll favor those establishments as well. Again, for the public eye, I want to thank my guest this week, James Conroy. The book is The Devils Will Get No Rest. If you have any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508 508- 952-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the Public Eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.